Chapter 38 Bulletproof. After the massacre at Sandy Hook, a number of my Republican colleagues responded by saying something on the order of, "This isn't just about guns. It's about the culture and mental health." As someone who'd been working on mental health issues since I got to the Senate, I knew that a number of these colleagues had never expressed any interest in the subject. It was like they were checking off a box by saying the words mental and health and saying them in the right order. Even worse, by raising mental health only in the context of gun violence, they were stigmatizing mental illness. The shooters in Newtown and Aurora and Tucson and Orlando were demented. And of course, early intervention can help avert some acts of violence, but the fact is that people with mental illness are on the whole no more likely to be violent and are actually more likely to be victims of violence than the general population. Virtually every family in America is touched by a behavioral health problem, mental illness or addiction. Addressing these issues in a smart, comprehensive, and compassionate way will relieve suffering, save families and lives, give us a more productive workforce, save tons of money in law enforcement and our prisons and in emergency room visits, and yes, maybe prevent someone from becoming so psychotic that they shoot up a movie theater or a nightclub or an elementary school. My friend Paul Wellstone was profoundly affected by watching his brother struggle with depression. And one of his Republican colleagues, New Mexico's Pete Domenici, was profoundly affected by his daughter's schizophrenia. So in the Senate, they teamed up to try to help Americans get the care they need. Back then, one barrier to getting that care was the exceptionally high cost of treatment. Many health insurance plans would cover surgery for a broken arm, but not medication for crippling anxiety or treatment for a drug addiction. Mental health issues were seen, at least within the health insurance market, as somehow less important or less real or, in any case, less worthy of coverage. Wellstone and Domenici tried to change that by fighting for what was known as mental health parity, which would simply require insurance plans that cover mental health services to cover them to the same extent as medical and surgical services. This extremely simple, extremely common sense, extremely humane reform didn't become law until October 2008. Yep, Paul Wellstone's most meaningful legislative achievement came 6 years after his death. The fight to pass the Wellstone-Domenici Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act was led in the House by Democrat Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island and Republican Jim Ramstead of Minnesota. Both are recovering alcoholics, but Patrick had the harder road to recovery. John F. Kennedy wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. But to me, the family's greatest profile in courage may well be Patrick. He never let his own very public and very embarrassing struggles with addiction and mental illness keep him from fighting to help others with mental health and addiction disorders get the care they needed. My own interest in mental health issues came partly from how much I respected Paul's work on the issue, and partly because, as you may recall, I too had been affected by loved ones who suffered from a behavioral disease, alcohol and chemical addiction. When I got to the Senate, I was eager to do my part to carry on Paul's legacy and, if possible, expand upon it. First step, pushing the Department of Health and Human Services to finalize the regulations prescribed by the Wellstone-Domenici Act. It was complex, painstaking work, and I was responsible for almost none of it. It was undertaken mostly by my health care legislative staff, working with the Department of Health and Human Services. And it remains a work in progress. Wellstone-Domenici is now fully implemented, and the Affordable Care Act built on its success by requiring that all policies sold through the exchange cover behavioral health services, including addiction treatment, which has been a lifesaver for many during the ongoing opioid crisis. But we are still nowhere near where we need to be in making sure that people who need treatment for mental illness and addiction can always get it. Then came the rash of mass shootings and the rash of national conversations about mental health. Lots of people were declaring that we needed to do something, but nobody was really clear on what exactly we could or should do. In frustration, I asked the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness how to respond. She gave me a one-word answer. Schools. She arranged a roundtable at a school in the Mounds View School District. The school had adopted an approach to mental health that seemed to be working. All the adults in the school community, from the principal and the teachers to the bus driver and the lunch ladies, had been taught what it looks like when a kid is dealing with mental health problems. If they saw a kid who seemed to be struggling, they could ask a mental health professional, a counselor, a psychologist, a social worker, or a therapist, to check in with the student and determine whether he or she had a serious mental health issue. That professional would connect the child with mental health services in the Mounds View community. At the round table, three mothers raved about what a difference this program had made for their children and their families. One in particular, Katie Johnson, made a profound impact on me. Katie told me that she was a single mother of two, a 9-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. "My son," she said, "was completely out of control. So my life was completely out of control. I was in total despair." One day, Katie got a call from a woman who introduced herself as the mental health advocate for Katie's son. "She's become my best friend," Katie told me. Katie's son was diagnosed with ADHD and Asperger's. They treated him, and he completely turned around. Now he's doing well in school, and he's taking Taekwondo. Katie looked me straight in the eye with the confidence of someone who had gone through a horrific ordeal and found herself safely on the other side. After years of chaos and frustration, her son was finally on the right track, and her own life finally felt manageable. Pointing to her heart, she told me proudly, "I am now bulletproof." I thought, let's do this. There was a gun bill working its way through the Senate, so I added an amendment that would fund training for people who work in schools to identify warning signs of mental illness and help detect and treat issues as early as possible. My colleagues understood the wisdom of the idea right away, and my provision passed by a nearly unanimous vote. But as you may recall, the gun bill failed. Still, the idea stuck. Soon after, we got $100 million in new funding to improve mental health services in schools, and we've gotten more since. This money has helped train a lot of adults in schools to intervene when a student is having trouble, and it's helped schools to hire a lot more counselors and social workers to treat those students, and it's helped a lot of kids. But not every kid. On an issue like mental health, there's never a big, dramatic final victory. There's never a signing ceremony where the president officially abolishes undiagnosed mental illness once and for all. Kids and adults struggle with mental illness every day, and too many of them never get the help they need. And that's just kind of how it works. Sometimes you work your whole life to do something simple and noble, and it doesn't happen until 6 years after your death. Sometimes it never happens at all. Sometimes you get 94 of your colleagues to vote for your amendment, but the bill itself fails on a cynical partisan filibuster. Sometimes you see a breaking news banner on the TV in your office and something awful has happened, and you get the creeping sensation that the whole sad national conversation is about to begin again. But sometimes you can make a little progress, and sometimes you get to see what that progress looks like. A few days after we secured that first batch of funding, I went to Westwood Elementary School in Bloomington, Minnesota for another roundtable. There was real excitement among the 20-some people who had heard about the new funding for programs like the one that was working in their school. Westwood has a therapist in residence, so parents don't have to take the better part of a day to pick their kid up to ferry them to and from an appointment. A 10-year-old boy told me how much his therapist, a cheerful young woman in her early 30s, had helped him. When he sees her in the hall during recess, he said, he gives her a big high five, Talk about destigmatizing. When you're a senator and you go to these roundtables, it's often just one person after another telling you incredibly sad or depressing or inspiring stories. Me being me, I have a ritual to sort of puncture the emotions so I can switch gears and get my head into the next event. And after this roundtable, my driver, Brett, and I walked out to the car, climbed in, buckled up, and per our ritual, I nodded at Brett and said, "Fooled him again." But this time I added, almost to myself, "I'm a good senator."